If you haven't heard our city's best musical group, according to Willamette Week's 2025 Best of Portland Readers poll, this Saturday's your chance. The Portland Youth Philharmonic, America's longest-running youth orchestra, continues its historic 102nd season with a concert titled Flames of Transformation, taking place Saturday, March 7th at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. The program, conducted by PYP's musical director David Hattner, includes Jessica Meyer's Turbulent Flames, Max Bruch's Scottish Fantasy, which features 2025 concerto competition winner Leo Trajano, and to close the concert, Howard Hanson's Symphony No. 3. As always, we're fortunate to have David here with us to preview Saturday's performance. David, Saturday's concert is the traditional PYP spring concert. It's called Flames of Transformation in the program. We've talked before about the concert titles, and I know that's not really your department, but this one seems perfect for the change in seasons when nature undergoes transformation. Maybe we do as well. And it reflects on the opening piece, which is Jessica Meyer's Turbulent Flames.
That's right. Jessica is an old friend of mine from my days in New York City. She's a brilliant violist who joined the faculty of the Manhattan School of Music as a viola professor recently. And she has a steadily rising profile as a top American composer with major commissions, including previous commissions from the Portland Youth Philharmonic. During the pandemic year when we were playing music online, she wrote a piece for her eight violas that we recorded virtually. And then we commissioned a piece from her because of that commission being so successful for women's voices and string orchestra, which we performed with In Mulieribus, I believe it was 3 years ago.
Oh, exactly. 2023. I remember because I interviewed Jessica for that along with Alicia, who did the words, and then the head of Mulieribus, and I think the conductor too. Mm-hmm. So it was a great interview, and what a wonderful piece.
It was. It was a really emotional and relevant piece that spoke and continues to speak to a lot of the things that affect women today. And I have very fond memories of it. It was extraordinarily challenging for our musicians, but whenever they work with singers, it's very elevating. So it was worthwhile. So when Jessica contacted me, I can't remember exactly when, but sometime around a year ago, and I was writing programs, and said, I got a new consortium commission, they call it. Would you like to join it? That's when multiple orchestras come together and each pay a portion of the fee to the composer. So they each get their own premiere in their area. And so for the Northwest United States, we signed on to Turbulent Flames. And it's a very challenging piece, like many of Jessica's pieces. It's a real burner. It's a fast.
Yes, no pun intended. She said about it, she had the title, apparently, before even writing the music. And she said, quote, I want to write a fiery piece for orchestra that combined a good amount of virtuosity, unpredictability, and fun. So that sounds like a challenge for the composer and the musicians.
It is. We've worked very hard on it, and especially since she told us she planned to attend the performance, it has given a little extra excitement to the whole process of preparing it. I only wish it could be on the concert with the Firebird Suite by Igor Stravinsky, which we'll be playing in May, but it didn't quite fit as well as it fits onto this program of mostly American works, which, of course, we're in a 250th anniversary of our declaration year. So it's time to play some American music by not only two fine American composers, but two composers who are educators.
Did you consult with, given your connection and you've known each other for a long time, did you consult with Jessica at all when preparing and rehearsing Turbulent Flames?
Only to ask about some suspected misprints in the parts and score, some of which were in fact incorrect, despite previous performers having gone through it. It's a really tremendously difficult job to proofread a whole orchestral score. So inevitably, there will be a few things that slip by. So we caught a couple of those. And I didn't have to ask her about the tempo markings because I've worked with Jessica on her pieces before, and she wants exactly the tempos that she's written, despite the fact that it would settle about 5% slower very nicely than she wants. She wants what she wants. So we've had to really push to replicate exactly what she's written down. And that should be enough to make all the parts of the piece work. It's that kind of piece where if you play it right and fit it together, it should represent exactly what she wants, as long as everyone plays the correct dynamics and it balances. So I'm hoping it will come off that way.
You know, I listened to a recording of it. It's only about 7 minutes, but man, it never lets up from the very first notes.
No, sometimes that's what is required. And audiences seem to like, you know, these kind of pieces that have high energy, especially to open a concert. And this is no exception. I think that people will enjoy it as it zooms by in the concert hall.
Now, the concert's second piece is Max Bruch's Scottish Fantasy. And that blends Bruch's roots as a German romantic composer. See, he's the only composer on the program who's not American. And it combines that with a traditional Scottish tune. The violin soloist is Leo Trajano, winner of PYP's 2025 concerto competition. I listened to a recording of this by another violinist and orchestra, and to me at least, man, it's a complex piece of music and a very demanding one for the soloist.
Yes, Bruch had the advantage of writing for the best violinists of his day. He wrote his famous first concerto for Joachim, the same violinist that Brahms and Dvorak wrote their concertos for. And this one is dedicated to Pablo de Sarasate, who was a great Spanish virtuoso, who also himself composed some still played very popular pieces for violin solo, including Zigeunerweisen and several other little encore style pieces. So he definitely utilized the resources of the instrument fully. Bruch had studied then fairly newly published editions of Scottish folk music that were available in Germany, and he never visited Scotland. He based his piece on the material in those books.
Leo himself is now 17 years old. He lives in Hillsborough. I read he started playing violin when he was 8.
That's a little late in our...
You've got some prodigies in the orchestra. Do you remember when Leo joined PYP, and as a music director, how do you help develop that kind of talent as a musician and performer?
Leo's only been with us. This is only his third year. So he did a lot of his learning before he came to PYP. Although I feel like the structure and the requirements that we put on the individuals have served him really well. I can't remember exactly where he was placed in the ensemble his first year, but he moved pretty quickly in the second year, pretty close to the front. I think he was possibly on the front stand of second violins last year, if I remember correctly, and then became one of the concert masters this year. But he's had a dramatic learning curve in the time we've spent together, certainly. He toured with the National Youth Orchestra of the USA last summer, which is a huge honor because they only take 100 musicians from the whole country, and usually not more than two or three from Oregon. We've always had a PYP student or two in it, and he and Katie Liu were the two representatives of PYP last year.
I saw that itinerary, David. They played Carnegie Hall, of all places, probably the most famous stage in America, and they said concert halls throughout Asia. So he's got some extremely valuable experience in these high-stress situations. And, of course, he was in the concerto competition. But it still must be nerve-wracking for any musician. How do you help them deal with that stress? Or is Leo just somebody who can go off on his own and get into a certain space where he's just ready and relaxed?
Well, I don't remember specifically working with any of our soloists on this aspect. It is a tremendously stressful situation because your best friends and colleagues are in the ensemble, although that's also an advantage at the same time. The soloists and I all know each other from usually years of working together before they become soloists. So they've seen others perform this role. In order to win, there has to be a tremendous level of preparation to begin with. So what we always preach at PYP is that preparation is the most important feeling to have when you go on stage to perform. There is an old sort of aphorism that people say, like, youth always rise to the occasion. We don't believe in that at all. I always say, usually people sink to their level of preparation. That's what happens most of the time. Every once in a while, somebody will rise up and, things will go better than they should have, and that. But you cannot count on this sort of thing. You can't have 102 years of the kind of success the Portland Youth Philharmonic has had, relying on the moment to bring people up to or past the level where they've actually prepared to be. We had to have a little chat about that at rehearsal last night, not to Leo, but about our other two pieces that we're not where we would like to be. There's been a lot of viruses and other things going on that have caused absences, and we still have a little work to do, and it has to be homework at this point. We have only one rehearsal remaining as a full orchestra for this concert. So Leo, like everybody else, knows that he's got to figure out how many hours he has to prepare and use it intelligently. And he's done a brilliant job. So it's going to be really the centerpiece of the concert. It was not the piece I programmed because it was chosen in a competition. So it sort of sticks out a little from the American pieces, but it's a favorite of audiences, and it's a really spectacular display for the violinist, and the orchestra has a lot of interesting things to do in support of the soloist as well. So it's a challenge for us and me as well.
Yeah, it was a new piece for me, and I listened to a recording on YouTube, and it was amazing. Just the kind of dynamics of it. The composer basically ends with this very beautiful violin solo at the end of the first movement, and then goes back to that again, and then this rousing ending kind of evolves from that. It was just tremendous.
Yes, well, Bruch is primarily known as a composer outside of Germany, in any case, for three works. The first violin concerto, this work, and the setting of Kol Nidre, the Jewish prayer for cello and orchestra. Aside from that, we play virtually nothing he wrote. There's a few chamber pieces that are done outside the orchestra repertoire, but this is kind of it. He was a good craftsman of solo works for string instruments. He wrote very well for the instruments and very effectively. And this is a great example of that. And of course, since he was not on the absolute top rank of composers, to have him borrow the primary material and merely develop it, I think shows him at the best of his craft. And so people should come hear it. Leo's a dynamic soloist and forceful personality, and he's worked very, very hard.
Now, the closing piece on Saturday's program is one that you did pick, and by another American composer. This is Howard Hanson, and it's his third symphony. In the program notes, it's called a cinematic, lyrical American masterpiece. And David, it mentions it was played many years ago by PYP.
Yes, I conducted it in 2010.
Oh, 2010. So that before we started doing our interviews, so I hadn't seen it. And you say it's due for a comeback.
Yes, Ken, I think we've talked about it before. I've repeated very few works in these
Yes.
18 seasons. This is probably only the sixth or seventh work that I will have done more than once. And as far as symphonies go, I've done one of the Tchaikovsky symphonies twice, and one of the Brahms symphonies twice, and one of the Dvorak symphonies twice, and that's it. Everything else has been new. I've conducted over 400 pieces on my programs here, so there had to be a reason to bring it back, and that reason is that Howard Hanson is really due for a reevaluation. We say this a lot about American composers that have been overlooked, but since contemporary music is now so much more warm and tuneful and tonal than it was in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s, it's time to look back a little further at the composers who were writing in that style when it was unpopular. And the 30s were really when it started to be looked down upon because that was the rise of the soundtrack. It was invented really in the late 20s when those Austrian and German immigrants like Korngold, Waxman, and Steiner sort of set what a Hollywood soundtrack would sound like. And remarkably, it sounds a lot like what Howard Hanson's music sound like. So it's not his fault that a lot of these warm, romantic gestures and ideas became part of this harmonic language that makes up Hollywood films. It just made his accomplishments suspect to some, like he was going for easy, cheap effects, the same way you would underscore a film. But he's not doing that. He's just writing what he meant to write in the first place, because that's who he was as a composer. was a real romantic. In fact, his second symphony.
Yes, I was going to say that. The second symphony is probably his best known work, and that's called The Romantic.
That's right. That's right. And I grew up hearing that symphony because a theme from it is associated very closely with the summer camp at Interlaken, and it's played on nearly every concert. So we all heard it literally thousands of times. But this third symphony is a little broader in scope. It's very interesting the way it's put together. And it has a much more of the darkness that allows the really bright, brilliant climaxes to shine even more, that there's a struggle in the symphony. Hansen loved Sibelius.
I was going to mention that. Actually, he comes from Swedish roots, his family.
Yes,
and Sibelius, of course, is Finnish. So there's a Scandinavian influence to the piece.
That's right. This work, which was written in the later 1930s, is dedicated to the Swedish immigrants of America, including in his Nebraska home. And he definitely looks to Sibelius both for the form and the harmonic ideas, and also this sort of struggle against darkness, which is common to all those northern composers because they spend so much of the year in darkness. They used to say about Sibelius, you know, he was so different from the other Europeans who come from further south, that, you know, the sun comes up at the end of a Sibelius symphony too. It just comes up over snow and ice.
And I should mention also that this third symphony was written to commemorate an historical event, the 300th anniversary of the first Swedish settlement in Delaware, and that was in 1638. Again, there's that Swedish roots to it, but a very American composer.
Yes, well, and a important figure in American music education because of the Eastman School of Music, which he was really the first director of the Eastman School and set the curriculum and the theme of the place, of which it still exists because of the work that he did from, he was only in his 20s when he became the director. He was a very young man, and he stayed a good 30 years there or more. And he also conducted the orchestra there, and every season gave a festival of American music where he played all kinds of American music. And starting in the 1950s, made recordings of American music for the Mercury label, which people still collect today. They're still available to hear, including this symphony and the other symphonies that existed at that time. He recorded the first, second, third, and fourth there. The last three symphonies came after he left the Eastman School. I've always enjoyed his music. It has a simple, lovable approach that the audience will not have to think too hard to appreciate. And it's worth really careful listening to, because he takes a lot of material from movements one and two and then develops them further in the last movement, which is a very interesting approach that not all composers have tried. And even accompanimental figures in the early parts of the piece become important motivic developments in the finale. And there's the centerpiece of the piece is the second slow movement with a beautiful theme, which we expect to hear in the finale, and we keep not hearing it. In fact, there's obvious spots where it's supposed to break out. Instead, he brings in one of those other tunes he's been developing. And then finally, 4 pages from the end of the score, finally, this tune reemerges, fully orchestrated, in full cry and counterpoint between the high and low instruments, and closes out the symphony. It ends triumphantly with this most beautiful theme of the symphony. So that's what makes it such a great, rewarding piece for our musicians to study and for me to conduct and for the audience to listen to.
And what a wonderful program. I learned a lot just prepping for our interview and listening to some of the recordings of pieces I hadn't heard before. And composers, we're not talking about the Dvoraks and the Beethovens and the Brahms and all that here. So it will be a great learning experience and also extremely entertaining for everybody who's there.
Yeah, I hope people will come. There's been so much excitement around PYP this year because of the purchase of our new home, where we have our offices now, and we'll have our rehearsals there starting next fall. Just generally, there's been a lot of positive feeling. Our executive director, Noreen, just had her 10th anniversary on the job. No executive director's ever stayed 10 years before, and it's been one triumph after another on the administrative side. Our board is doing a phenomenal job supporting us, and our, you know, musical efforts are producing, I would say, typical results, which is to say extraordinary.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, which was recently voted our city's best musical group in Willamette Week's Best of Portland Readers Poll. The orchestra's annual spring concert, titled Flames of Transformation, takes place this Saturday, March 7th, at Portland's Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, starting at 7:30 p.m. You can find out more and purchase tickets online at pdxyouthphil.org. This is Ken Jones for KBOOS News In Depth.